This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome back to another episode of our Think and Drink series that regularly invites international speakers to present their work. This series is being recorded at the colloquium of Georg Simmel Center for Urban Studies in collaboration with the Humboldt University of Berlin.
Our speaker today is Michele Lancione, an urban scholar who is not only thinking about cities, but also actively reshaping how we understand them. Michele is professor of economic and political geography at the Polytechnic University of Turin, as well as visiting professor at the University of Sheffield. What does it mean to be at home when home is the expression of structural forms of violence at the intersection of anthropocentrism, patriarchy, heteronormativity, and racial capitalism? As the COVID-19 pandemic showed, home can be read as a juncture where many of the inequalities of our time come and are held together structurally. Yet, at the same time, home maintains an attractive lure to itself, as a place one is called to defend or to work toward, in order to be freed from subjections that seem to render home impossible in the first place. In this talk, the aim is to stay close to this only apparent contradiction, which Michele would like to name the impossible possibility of home. With this notion, he interprets the unjust and violent foundations of home not as opposite to, but as foundational to its capacity to allude to one's own betterment in terms of belonging, security, and care. This means to say that the lure of home as a space of belonging is emerging from the foundations of home itself, rather than being a means towards salvation from its violence. The impossible possibility of home lies in home's capacity to sell a diagram of liberation as a line of flight, a breakthrough from its unjust underpinnings, while in imminent lived and felt terms, that diagram is a very powerful function of those. Now, we do hope you enjoy the talk.
So essentially what I want to discuss here is related to that book. It's called For a Liberatory Politics of Home. By the way, you find it inside the library, so I'm not publicizing it. And essentially, what I try to do with that book is to pose a critique to notions of home, especially what it means to belong and to be at home in Italy. Departing from the assumption that home is somewhat detached from the other of home, from homelessness. How can we think home not in opposition to homelessness, but together with homelessness? And when I say homelessness, I don't just mean rough sleeping, as I hope it will become clearer in a second. And I also want to say that I theorize from Italy, but the argument that I'm making around the inner violences of home extend beyond that context. This violence have to do with what houses are made to do and with the inner violence constituting many projects of home and belonging. And I think we learn a lot from Palestine in relation to that. And the problem here to me is not just one of domicides, as the UN Rapporteur for the Right to Housing rightly affirms, but there is something more profound related to how a project of the homely is made to stand through the destruction of other homes. And such destruction is not outside of the settler colonial home, but right into it as a prerequisite of it. It's more intimate, using Hagar Kotev words, object of violence. The reason why I'm referring to this is also because the work of Hagar Kotev was very important to my own work. So the argument that I'm making starts with the traumatic experience of living at the tail end of housing precarity and housing injustice, what we usually call homelessness, and it is there that I would like to start. But its implications, as I said, are wider and are not just related to literature and approaches concerning with the so-called homeless, but is a call for a renewed approach to the histories and geographies of habitation, colonizing our imagination and practices of home in the West. I would like to start with Paolo. Paolo is a person I met in 2009 when I was doing my fieldwork in Turin during my PhD. He was about my age at the time, was about around 40. Paolo was telling me about a therapeutic community for drug users located in Tuscany. He spent some time in this community in the early 2000s. And part of the story was about how he got hooked to cocaine and heroin also when the stuff was freely available on the road. And part of the story was about him smuggling cocaine for tourists traveling to Kenya. But there was also this affair of trying to get by in Turin, a city where he could sometimes afford to pay for shelter and sometimes he couldn't. Distributing flyers played a big role, he told me. Leafleting advertisements for a supermarket chain, a pizza joint, a new furniture shop that had just opened at the edge of town. Above Paolo, a chain of commissioning, a boss who was receiving the leaflets from another boss who got them from the company. And Paolo was extracting too. He had three employees whom he described as più fottuti di me, more fucked up than me. They worked a little, pretending mostly, and then threw the leaflets in the bins alongside the banks of the River Dora. The cast of life was raw for Paolo. The showers in the homeless shelter of Via Sacchi shared with dozens of others, the nights without heating in the soffitta he managed to rent, a dark attic room for which he needed no documents, no proof, only ready cash and enough balance to make it up the steep stairs without looking down the well. The cheap alcohol he drank, a trade-off for heroin, the lack of meaningful encounters. He once told me, "It seems as if the only people I meet are people like me and non abbiamo niente da dirci. We have nothing to say to each other." His body shaking, frail, cold. Paolo loved making collages. He opened a Facebook account, made YouTube videos, delivering a peaceful message in search of a voice, a narrative that moved at his own tempo. Later on, we both had left Turin, and there was this reapproachment with his mother and the new woman he was now seeing, whom he liked. He was living in a tiny garden shack in someone else's property, but his life was more serene. He could think about his passion for football and for dogs. He would download pictures of puppies from the web, then put glasses on them using Windows Paint, adding some flowers, the symbol of Cagliari culture, and the word peace. He was taking care of his own dwelling in his own world. Paolo, the heroin addict, Paolo, the drunken, the boss, the dispossessed, the peer educator, the giver and taker, the informant and friend, the sunburned hustler, Paolo the less, Paolo the homeless. Now, Paolo is the other of home. He lacks shelter. He lacks ontological security. He roams in a field of becoming populated with subjectivities that in the worst case are racialized, dispossessed, and jailed, while in the best case are rendered a subject waiting to be studied and in need to be saved. One might ask, who does such a rendering? For Paolo clearly might have seen himself as someone lacking a proper dwelling and a just way of inhabiting planet Earth, but he did not see himself just as that. It is as if in order to make sense of Paolo's place in the world and in order to be able to deal with that, as if something must be expelled from him. That such segmentations there sounds obvious. Most here would have thought, well, of course, if the man needs housing, he must be dealt with as someone who needs that thing. We cannot deal with the rest. It would become unmanageable. Such thought process, indeed, is at the core of the leading approaches to fix homelessness, at least in the West. So, for example, the following text shows how leading scholars of homelessness across the Atlantic, the UK, US, and Europe, who are all working with their own respective national governments, are proposing to develop a global framework for conceptualizing and measuring homelessness. Who's who and what is expelled in order to extract what can be contained within such powerful frameworks. Here we are confronted with people living into tents, cheap hotels, streets, temporary accommodations, cars. But we are never really confronted with people. Here we are confronted with a series of spotlights on specific points of a vast region in a move that renders the view of the overall structural and relational cartography, I'm talking about the subjective cartography, the cartography of the subject, not only impossible, but unnecessary. So it is at the threshold of this particular point of how things get dealt with, where I began to look at home and homelessness a little bit differently. The epistemic and material creation of the other of home, it is not a side effect of something that went wrong at home, such as market failings, policy shortcomings, family breakings. And it is neither just a perverse form of revanchist control on deviant populations. Rather, it is home itself that is violent. In this view, Paolo is no other to home. Paolo, the homeless, is always already at home. So I'm trying to ask, and this is a provocative question to try to situate the argument I'm making in policy. Would it be enough to shelter all the homeless in the world to end homelessness? Would it be enough to shelter Paolo to end his homelessness? Confronted with his struggles, the immediate answer would be a resounding yes. This is what humanitarian approaches, but also liberal approaches such as housing first would argue. But answering yes to such a question means to avoid tackling the fundamental questions underpinning the possibility for Paolo to be made less in the first place. What is housing going to solve without a deeper questioning of the ways in which issues of class, consumption, mental health, migration, race, and construction of nationhood contribute to produce subjectivities made less, rendered less, managed as less, warped out as less, jailed as less, who can only escape these entrapments as less in further subtraction, either by hiding out or by taking their own life. And there is a reason why I make this point, which become clearer later in the talk. So despite what common sense dictates, homelessness does not end with housing, and crucially, homelessness does not end at home. The same normative home that has expelled Paolo can take him back, continuing being all the same. That home, even in taking him back, would still bear all chances of making him redundant once more. Such a home cannot be the solution to homelessness. Such a home is a less, for it is founded on the possibility of its annihilation. Therefore, in my reading, home and homelessness are a matter of the same. I invite here to transcend a binary reading of the two and to speak instead of homelessness, where the lessness is in parentheses. And by that, I mean the common violent substratum through which home gets to replicate itself via processes of expulsion and extraction, of which I will say in a second. Now, talking of homelessness is to affirm that home contains in itself the possibility of not being at home. Home contains in itself the possibility of not being at home. Now, think of this collectively for a second. Can you imagine home without its other? Can you imagine a notion of the homely that is constituted without the need to add another to that? And when I say other to that, the most simple way to think about this is nature. Home is constituted vis-a-vis the wilderness of what is constituted as nature. This is Maria Kaika's work, okay? So can you imagine home without its other? This is what I call the impossible possibility of home, the title of the talk. For one can be made to inhabit the space of the less without requiring home to alter its parameters. Paul is there, and home is there too. In refusing to see home and homelessness as distinct, I do not dismiss the different ways in which their same foundation is experienced. The experience of living rough or in a violent household or under the constant threat of eviction is experiential enough in common with the privilege I'm having as a white, non-binary person reading these notes to you, surrounded by people I love, with a working combi boiler in my house and a relatively stable mortgage backed by secure salary, or at least I believe it is secure. Now, thinking about homelessness does not mean that we are all homeless in the canonical sense of the word. Very, very, very far from it. It means that we are all at home, and the home is really violent and needs to be burned down. Not adjusted, not solved, not fixed, but burned down. It means to say that the sharpest experiences of homelessness, including, but not limited to, sleeping rough, living in camps, prison, violent household, gender and cis-normative spaces and racialized lives, are not taking place in realms separated from the idyllic pastures of homes, but are part of it. Put simply, home is not what saves from displacement and dispossession, but possible because it displaces and dispossesses. So, what is home all about then? If home does not grant salvation, what does it grant? Home, I argue, is a colonial project. And I'm taking this expanding on Agarkotek's work, okay? Home is a colonial project. It is a method of colonial production of subjects, spaces, affects, relations. Saying that home is a colonial project does not mean to flatten the discourse around settler colonialism, and it is in its specific of land grabbing and occupation. But it is possible nonetheless to recognize how the fundamental diagrams at play through the letter are key to the inner constitutive dynamics of home too. As Said reminded us, for a colonial project to exist, something and someone needs to be occupied and therefore to be constructed as worth being occupied. So in the book, I work with Mezzadra and Nelson to show how the bordering of the homely works precisely in this sense. It is a diagram doing what Said has talked about through two concomitant moves. First, home carves out a space for itself by defining an alterity. And second, while keeping that alterity at bay, it constitutes a violent relationship with that alterity through which values in the form taken by cultural standing, sustenance, security, profit, and belonging can be extracted and become essential for the reproduction of home itself. So my question here for you today is, what is home in contemporary racial financial capitalism without its otherness? How can its mainstream security, its belonging, its ecological, economic, gendered, racial, and vitalist affordances be maintained if one breaks through the definition and management of the alterity at its core? Now, answering this specific question requires identifying the affective and political economy of home more precisely. So in the book, I expand in a number of ways on this point, which I cannot really do here. I discuss some of the colonies of home, such as the constitution of the homely via the creation of nature and of the wild other, the constitution of the homely via the reproductive economy of patriarchal and heteronormative spaces, hence the creation of a specific femininity and gender binaries attached to a perceived feminine and masculine body, The constitution of the homely as a white space and of a national whiteness in the case I investigate in Italy, vis-a-vis the creation and management of the black other, as well, of course, the capacity of capitalist flows to intersect these borders and made them work in productive ways to generate all sorts of values. Now, I don't have time here to expand on all of this, but I just want to spend a few minutes to highlight the conceptual grammar to navigate this particular border that allows for home to stay in place, and echoing traditions spanning from Marxist, feminist, and black thinking, I am deploying two specific notions here. One is that of expulsion, and the other is that of extraction. Hold on with me for another 5 minutes, and then I will try to unpack this with some empirical grounding. But this grammar is important because without this grammar, it's impossible, I believe, to unpack the colonial project of home. Now, the first point that allows home to be maintained through this kind of bordering processes is that of expulsion. Now, expulsion, if you want, is a double-faced segmentation. What I mean by this, the two kinds of segmentations are taking place. Remember that table I showed you before, okay? First of all, expulsion is a cutting off of the other while entailing its creation as other. This is what Said wrote about. So on the one hand, expulsion creates a normative assemblage by selectively deciding what belongs and what is made to fit. On the other hand, it engages in a process of othering, silencing, and erasing that which doesn't fit, which comes to be defined against the exclusionary norm. Now, importantly, this kind of expulsion is not Saskia Sassen's expulsion. It's not that something is thrown out there. This is not what I'm describing. It's the segmentation of a complex realm of subjecthood and subjectivity that home needs in order to stand. It constitutes an otherness, it defines what nature is as such, and then it relates to that violently. What is expelled is everything that nature could be, that is not contained within that definition. Everything that is expelled is everything those people living in camps, living in tents, living in shacks could be, but is not taken into account. Because this particular segmentation, this particular expulsion is needed to do what? To extract value from that thing. That's why I speak of extraction. On the threshold of expulsion, extraction is operationalized. Now, the value that is extracted through expulsion includes a broad set of social, cultural, and economic assets. These can include social affirmation, parental authority, moral justification, accrual of epistemic privilege. I mean, this is what we do as academics continuously, right? Expulsion and extraction are those two functions made to work across the land of lessness, of what is constantly made less, in order to maintain and reproduce home in its current fashion. An impossible possibility founded in defining its otherness and in extracting legitimacy and power from it. There are multiple of these kind of operations at home. The homely as an opposition, but in vital relationship to nature, as I said already. It's not that nature is simply trashed out there. I mean, we need to relate to that. Political ecology, all of that. Resources to make this work, right? The ontological secure vis-a-vis the other. The power of man as a cisnormative carving out of power from women and who's not adequately man. So this kind of bordering I'm talking about is not just related to the physical world of the house. It happens within the home. Now, I try to explore in my research a number of these bordering practices, but then I ground the analysis on the case of Italy and on a specific sets of borderings that I identify following the late Umberto Eco when he discussed the notion of ur-fascism or eternal fascism. Now, for Eco, the Italian Resistenza won the battle against the fascist regime, but not against a much deeper cultural fascism he defines as ur-fascist. And here I'm quoting Eco. Ur-fascism is a series of characteristics including machismo, cult of tradition, appeal to the frustrated middle classes, fear of difference, contempt of the weak, close parenthesis. Now, in this language, there is the lexicon of patriarchy and of racialized class formations. And so I try to explore these particular sets of borderings that have to do with patriarchy, heteronormativity, and racial capitalism in Italy through ethnographic work, but also through the analysis of papal speeches, which is very fun, fascist colonial documents, contemporary laws, and popular culture. And here, I just want to give you an example, not on patriarchy and heteronormativity, but on the productive bordering grounded on racial capitalism in the Italian home. Now, the racialized link between land, law, and blood becomes the structure of today's Italian home and a means to defend it vis-a-vis the wilderness of the black other. This is a bordering process that goes back to Mussolini, and even before, through which, as Camilla Hawthorne has argued, and here I'm quoting, African bodies are remarked as iconic signifiers of illegitimate belonging, suggesting that their very being in an Italian place threatens the moral purity of the nation state, close parenthesis. Now, in the book, I trace the lineage of the racist Italian home, starting with the fascist colonial project, as well as through the writings of Catholic popes that I really don't have time to explore here, unfortunately. Now, a telling example, though, is the matter of citizenship. Even after the demise of the fascist regime, the state reaffirmed legal belonging was possible only on the basis of jus sanguinis, by which citizenship is transmitted only from a parent or ascendant in possession of citizenship themselves, therefore providing for the continuation of the whitening principles inscribed by the racial colonial state to date. Now, following Valeria De Plano, a critical historian from Italy, here I'm quoting Valeria, by maintaining the same inclusion and exclusion criteria devised in 1912, with all their racist undercurrents, the nation Republic of Italy became a state that was still heavily imbued with colonialist culture. Now, citizenship here works as a bordering process through which happens what I said before with the words of Camilla. Now, crucially, it's not only that all black others, and this is really my point, are banned, expelled in the assassin way, but it is that their selected inclusion takes place through an act of expulsion. If they can accept the racial script, leaving out what is not needed, homely Italian belongings might be enjoyed. Such expulsion is, of course, productive. It reinforces a whitened discourse of Italianness. It creates political legitimacy. Think of Giorgia Meloni. It activates economic profit-making. Let me give a brief example of this kind of extraction from this kind of expulsion as the basic grammar of the contemporary Italian home. The first relates to the provision of cheap labor to serve the nation's culinary needs. I think you all love your Italian pasta, so I'm going to ruin it for you. An economy of subjects made not to belong formally in order to be forced to work illegally stands out in that production of that pasta. Here I'm referring to the agro-mafia business, a form of illegal recruitment of workers, very common in the production of vegetables, and in particular in the picking of tomatoes, but also other vegetables in the southern region of Italy. In the Apulia region during peak season, there are around 15,000 such illegal workers. Salaries are not by the hour, but related to how many boxes of tomatoes one can fill. And reports says that workers are given 3 euros for a 375 kilos box. 3 euros. Water, food, and transportation are charged to the worker, who often lives in abandoned factories, shacks, and tents for the entire working season. So the worker is technically homeless, as described before. Through this, Italy maintains its standing as the second biggest producer of tomatoes in the world, and the Italian home can enjoy its whiter, heteronormative pasta seasoned with cheap pomodoro sauce. A question I usually ask, I get at the end of this, is why pasta is heteronormative. This is the cliffhanger. I will tell you maybe later if you ask me. Now, such system is an expulsive, destructive diagram of power working through a double elision. On the one hand, there is the disappearance of labor. Tomatoes arriving the Italian home without signs of the traumatic becoming inscribed in them. On the other hand, there is the social disappearance of the migrant, never seen or heard, and those requests to belong is systematically rejected by the state because of the reasons I said before in relation to citizenship and not on. Now, as the sociologist Gennaro Vallone argued, migrant workers are reproduced as alien, extraneous, absent subjects, although very present. Present for production, absent for everything else. There is something that is taken, but before that taking is possible, the construction of that racialized otherness needs to be grounded at the core of belonging. The second diagram of extraction is related to the asylum seekers' reception system. For those who do not request asylum, or for those to whom refugee status is denied, there are the permanence and repatriation centers, or CPR, like this one. Now, one of the first encounters I had when I moved back to Italy, regretfully, 4 years ago, it was with the story of Moussa Bald, a 23-year-old Ghanaian man who migrated to Italy in 2017. His story, the story of Moussa, like Andrew's story, is very complex. However, its ending is tragically straightforward. On Sunday, May 23, 2021, Moussa took his life within Turin's CPR. He held himself in the cell where he had been locked up a few days earlier as the result of his arrest by police in Ventimiglia in the Liguria region. He was arrested after he was beaten and dispossessed by a group of three fascists in the city street on May 9. The fascists got away free. The police didn't do anything to them. But Moussa was detained because the police, while escorting him to the hospital, found out that his residence permit had expired. So for this reason, after only 10 days of hospital care, he was moved into the Turin CPR. Local activists were able to speak to some of the other inmates, and one of them confirmed that, and here I'm quoting, despite showing clear signs of suffering caused by injuries on his body, Moussa was never examined by a doctor or member of the medical staff at the CPR, close parenthesis, close quote. Now, Moussa was trying to find a place to inhabit Italy. After being entrapped in the perverse logic of the asylum procedures, then being beaten for the color of his skin, then jailed, then put in isolation, then denied medical care. Now, in an interview recorded in 2018, not long after his arrival in the country, he stated his desire for habitation. Here I'm quoting Moussa, "I would like to stay in Italy because in this country I have had a taste of how beautiful life can be. I would like to study in order to find a good job and live well," end quote. The boundaries of the Italian home are not designed to give space to the desire of habitation of the migrant worker, the asylum seekers like Moussa, the conventionally homeless like Paolo, but also to many other subjectivities made less at the intersection of heteronormativity, patriarchy, racism, ecological disaster, class struggle, ableism, and more. The purpose of the boundaries of the homely is precisely to shut down such desire, not simply because of an ephemeral or transitory political will. It's not because of Giorgia Meloni, but because the foundations of home are deeper and speak to the wider and shared racialized and nationalist earth fascism of which Eco was writing about. The violent logics of the Italian home extends itself beyond the household and come back there in a fold, the threshold I was describing before, to work as the ultimate border in practice for forms of ontological securities that, grounded in past and present colonial histories, are now characterized not only by pasta, mortgages, baptism, and marriages, but also by the figure of the hanged black person in the detention center, or that of the refugees awaiting asylum, riding around in circles on a bike, the cheapest and only forms of transportation available to them. They have been refused citizenship. They have been refused ground. They have been defined as unwelcome. And yet, they are kept close by to feed and to justify homes where they will never, ever belong, but they need them to stand on their rotten foundations. On this basis, I conclude by asking, how can this kind of home, the home I just described to you, how can this kind of home pretend to save its other? Why should the subject that is made to experience expulsion, in order to become a value asset of the homely through extraction, why that subject should be brought back home? The problem here is not just with the creation of that subject, the poor, the refugee, the homeless, but with what society decides to do with that creation. What state, religious, and humanitarian institutions do is the crux of the issue of the colonial project of home, institutionally at least. So on the one hand, these institutions, and in Italy, the major player here is the Catholic Church. On the one hand, this institution could disrupt the continuity between the home that has expelled the subject and the one that is supposed to supposedly is there to take them back. They could disrupt the linearity between these two holes. That would mean directly tackling what is structuring home. It would not mean to house all the homeless of the world to save homelessness. And the reason why I say this is because policies like Housing First are sold to governments worldwide precisely under the tenet of solving homelessness. This is the language. And I know this because I've been consulting several governments on this Housing First bullshit, okay? Now, Housing First does something very important. But it does not solve homelessness, okay? Because homelessness does not end in housing and homelessness does not end at home. It would not mean to house all the homeless in the world to solve homelessness. It would mean in the quintessential restoration of housing to challenge the expulsive and extractive logics of nationalism and racial capitalism to cite just two of the processes that I have evoked. Now, the other option is for the institutions managing the other, and academia is one of these institutions, for institutions that are there to manage the other by creating the other, for these institutions to continue to do what they do, to reproduce and maintain the multiple alterities of home without altering the basic formula of control, of colonial control, even when they manage to shelter the other. So what I try to do here is to offer a proposition for a different kind of endeavor. Home must not be fixed. The other home must not be saved. And there is a reason why I use the language of saving, because this is crucial in the Catholic context I'm coming from, okay? Home needs instead to be liberated. And if you hear echoes of queer thinking, it's because this is a queer book. Home needs instead to be liberated, coherently with the need to produce affirmations to get beyond the binaries of lessness, or what is constantly made less. I define liberated as a sort of a break to allow for an emancipatory desire or habitation to emerge and to take place into the world. The desire of habitation that you heard in the word of Musa. The desire of habitation that you saw in the collage of Paolo. My own desire of queer habitation, your own desires. Now, such a capacity to allow for such desires to come true is not the end point of the revolutionary effort. It cannot be given. But it is the ongoing struggle to affirm that another way of inhabiting the world is possible, another way of being at home is possible. And here, just to very briefly conclude, I want to speak about three strategies I engage in the final part of this book. I'm sure there are many more, but I'm starting with these three. And the reason why I'm starting with these three and not others is because I center my site of labor, the academy, as one of the places through which home must be liberated. So the first point has to do, these are three moves, okay? The three moves are deinstituting, reinstituting, instituting, okay? The first point is a reflection on the work of Veronica Gago, a reflection on the power of Nonnulla di Meno to rethink home. And it has to do with deinstitution through striking. Veronica Gago, as you know, speaks of striking as a strategy. The focus here is on deinstitutionalizing and fighting against the industries currently caring for the other of home, which include much of the current service provision for the homeless, as well as the knowledge production around them. So I call here for the total deinstitution of homeless service provision as we know it today, but also of homelessness scholarship, which is for the most a pile of useless but dangerous crap. Now, when I say the institution, you should hear abolition. So I call for the abolition of homeless service provision as we know it today. Now, abolition is not simply let's close and save the money and run away. Abolition is investing more, trying to find a way that does not require the constitution of an otherness in order for a service to stand. The institutionalizing service provision is not something to be done through the funding, but through abolition, and move that indeed will require more funding, care, and dedication. The goal here is to stop the circuit of value extraction from the other via its creation and control to enable situated interventions tackling the multiple violences of home. One of the best and simple practices for me as somebody who manages researchers and has to do with students is that when a student comes to me and say that they want to do another set of same structure interviews with the homeless that are rough sleepers that are out there, my answer is no, we don't do this. This doesn't add anything. This reproduces cycles of extraction via reproducing that subject as a subject of the less and by reproducing constantly us as subjects of in need of extraction. Now, in order to arrive there, in order to arrive to this kind of deinstituting practice, a second move would have to do with the reinstitution, with what I call reinstitution through radical care. Here, the focus is on allowing ourselves to relearn how to care for habitation and its struggles, and to constitute on that basis, on the basis of struggle, a universal approach to housing focused on dwellers' control. The apparent resonance of this point with some current policies, like housing first, is demystified in the book, but also in what I have said before. Because in my approach, housing does not come first. And to be honest with you, housing does not come first even in housing first. In housing first, housing is part and parcel of a liberal take on poverty management. In restitution, what is instituted again is housing, yes, but as a project to learn how to care for habitation. Now, thinking with UK housing anarchists and the Italian operaisti, I center the practice of autonomy as central to such endeavor. And we had many examples of this in our cities, albeit they have been kicked out by gentrifying processes, of this kind of homely practices where housing becomes not just the container for forms of care, but housing is part and parcel of how care is defined, the use of space. Now, on this particular threshold of re-educating for a form of habitation centered around radical care, and if you want, later we can define what this radical care really means, on that particular threshold, we should work with a form of institution that does not require institutional validation. Is an institution of a will, of a desire of becoming through affirmation. Now, this last move is focused on considering occupation and grassroots organizing as a viable alternative to interventions focused on policy change. Institution is therefore about bypassing state inertia and prefiguratively enacting a liberatory politics of form in the here and the now. Now, I do not intend the institution to be a plan. This kind of instituting, I don't intend it to be a plan, a solution for all. Affirmation is a practice to and by localized communities, to and by individuals, and not a planetary theory of how to solve homelessness, okay? It is easier to keep a binary reading of home and homelessness, to assume that all considered, home is better than nothing, and that we might be able to incrementally fix it. This is the easy way out. But such a posture carries an epistemic and material colonial virus that we must reject. The practice of deinstituting, reinstituting, and instituting can be already found in forms of collective organizing, squatting, community-based direct action, and their strength. The real strength of this kind of practices lies in rejecting ideas of a fix for all, in avoiding a fidelity scale. Liberation from homelessness, in this sense, will not consist of a new home, a new home. It will be the intensification of struggles against expulsion and extraction, leading to thousands different ways of doing home. And here I come to possibly the most beautiful quote around home ever that you know for sure already. But this quote is not the starting point. This is the guiding point. In such a view, no formation, no homely can be considered entirely safe, not for all, not forever. No arrangements and no design can accommodate once and for all. Here is where we can go back to Balux, where home really becomes an open-ended process, a place to call, to quote, which enables and promotes varied and ever-changing perspectives, a place where one discovers new ways of seeing realities, frontiers of difference. The most beautiful part in this quote are the plurals. No home, no fix, ever-changing, struggle. Such a homely place, to be coherent with its definition, can only be an ongoing revolution, a liberatory homing praxis leading to a variety of forms, a multiplicity of housing use values, united by guiding principles pointing beyond expulsion and extraction. That's the guiding principle. The way you decline it must be grounded in the situated histories you come from. So from my own limited vantage point, I have mentioned three proposals: the refusals of controlling so defined homeless others, the need to recenter a differential way of caring about our capacity to constantly redoing home, and the practice of constituting affirmatory ways of working through the unjust, violent grounds of lessness, the violent making less we all currently inhabit. Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter